it was the first real sound that had ever been transmitted to a human ear by electricity.
Hi everyone and welcome to episode 2 of The Music Dissectors, recorded April 12th, 2017. It's great to be back for a second episode, although I am flying solo today. Now that's not because Matthew's left the band and decided he hates me, anything near as dramatic as that, although I wouldn't blame him in the longer term, he's only human. He is in fact on a long planned and well-earned break with which the recording of today's episode clashed. So hope you're enjoying your break, Matthew, and he will definitely be back for episode 3 unless I happen to run this thing in the ground today. I want to thank the handful of people who have given feedback on the first episode. We're glad you enjoyed it. And again, a big thanks to Will Henshaw for helping us out as a first guest where he talked about Tubular Bells. And it doesn't get much further away from Tubular Bells than the discussion we're going to have today. So we're going to pure Australian rock. As you probably already worked out from the title of the podcast, we're going to talk some In Excess and specifically their album Listen Like Thieves. And the man who's going to join me as a guest is someone that happens to have picked up 2 ARIA Awards for his work behind the mixing console and is still kicking some big sound engineering goals today. He's had a career in the music industry of more than 30 years. His name's Al Wright. As you'll hear, we happen to know each other. I just personally think he's one of the nicest guys I've ever met, and I'd argue one of Australia's best sound engineers, both previously and today. So if you grew up in Australia in the 80s, there's no way you don't know about Listen Like Thieves, and worldwide there's not a lot of music fans who probably don't know about In Excess. So as you'll hear, Al's relationship with this album is pretty close and it makes for some fascinating listening. So enjoy. Al, thanks for jumping in for a chat today.
My pleasure, David.
I'm wondering if before we get underway, whether we should start about our sordid history together. not the sexual stuff.
Well, the poor Kembla glory hole. They were the days, huh? I hadn't seen your face for 2 years.
Oh, for those outside of Wollongong, I'm not even going to attempt to explain that one, but you don't want to know. So Al and I go back. I haven't actually done the maths, Al. We worked together. I know I started work in the same area as you did in 97.
I think I started about 95.
Yeah, and so we did, amongst other things, used to go to schools and do combined drug and alcohol and sex education sessions. I remember I'd do the drug and alcohol component and you would get the banana that unsheathed as a penis and show the people how to put on a condom. Yep. So couldn't get much further away from music, but that's our history. And I honestly didn't know that much about Al's background, which you're about to hear more about at the moment.
So, you know, I'm fully qualified in sex, drugs and rock and roll.
All three.
I have diplomas and degrees.
Literally.
To prove it, yeah.
So, yeah, it's impressive. So we'll hear more about Al's history in a minute. But, yeah, we have. So just a disclosure, we have worked together previously. Al gave me the honour of being... I was going to say best man.
Well, I was
a good man. You very kindly attended my wedding, so we have known it, but haven't seen each other for a lot of years.
No.
And so just ran across each other on the good old Facebook again, and that led to this.
Here
so,
we are.
Yes. Now, this is a bit of a different episode as well, in that we usually get people on to talk about albums that have impacted their lives from either emotional or spiritual or whatever it is impact. This one's a little bit different in that there might, and we'll find out whether there's been that impact, but also you had a direct hand in the album. So probably to start off, do you want to tell us a bit about, outside of this album you've chosen, your history in the music industry?
Sure. So the album I chose is In Excess's 1985 Listen Like Thieves album. And I chose it because it had a marked impact on my career as a sound engineer, my career as a studio owner, and as chief engineer of Rhinoceros Studios, and just meeting those people. Yep, so I'll go back now. So my introduction to music was through my uncle. He was 6 years older than us, and he lived in our house. He didn't live at his own house. And he loved playing guitar. And so he had a band, and I was 14, so he was almost 20. Mm. And he used to grab me to do the PA and help him lug in the pubs. 14 years old in the pubs in 1971 and stuff, it wasn't an issue. You could even drink beer if you wanted to.
Right.
But I didn't want to because I was probably too stoned. So I set up the PA. It was just, you know, two mics, column PA, two channels, bang. That's it, easy as. And it just basically it progressed from there. I was lucky enough to do a little bit of work at Early Albert's and then King Street, and then met some chaps. They were building a studio. And I was lucky enough to get invited to come in because of my skills in, I'm an interior designer by trade. Sounds, you know, pretty highfalutin, but I used to do shag pile carpet in luxury cruises and
that
stuff.
That wasn't around the 70s and 80s, was it?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, love hearts at the back of the bed in the yacht. Oh. I used to do that sort of thing. So that worked perfectly for studios.
Yeah.
Because it's all about soft and hard surfaces for reflections. So they brought me in, I did all that, and they had no money, so they paid me in shares, and I had some money, I put some money in to buy materials and stuff, and it was a match made in heaven. And at the end of building, it took us a year to build, this is Rhinoceros Recordings in Goulburn Street, Surry Hills. Mm. That was 1980.
Okay.
We finished that. Started off as 16-track. And we ended up being fully-fledged 48-track in a couple of years with the first SSL desk in the Southern Hemisphere.
So you were not only chief engineer there, but you were essentially an owner.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Junior owner.
Yeah, junior owner. Yeah. So that's built only five years before Listen Like Thieves was recorded. And so
exactly.
My understanding, and there's lots of stuff on the internet that's rubbish, but one of the reasons they chose Rhinoceros was because of the level of equipment and cutting edge, how cutting edge you were.
Yeah, we had the best gear and the best sounding rooms.
Yeah.
So we were lucky, and we were also very smart. So we got good gear, and we were lucky in the sense that the rooms that we built and designed actually worked. Mm. So as a team, between all of us, we had one really good brain.
That's all it takes.
Our drum room was to die for. It just worked out so well. The carpenter did a phenomenal job on that.
And Rhinoceros not still around, is it?
No.
No, no.
No, it's folded in 92.
Yeah, yeah.
Through a couple of reasons. Mismanagement, drugs and rock and roll.
Yeah, yeah.
And Paul Keating.
Okay.
The recession killed us.
Oh, of course. Yeah, no, yeah. And, of course, before we jump into the album specifically, you've been a little bit modest, which I know is a bit like you. So you've had a hell of a career within Rhinoceros and
it's
outside
of it. It's hard to say,
isn't it? And outside of it. So just give us a potted history of some of the stuff you've done. And I know you don't like – well, I'm not sure you don't like talking about your ARIA Awards, but I know it's only a small part of what's a very big career.
Yep.
But, yeah, just give us a potted history.
I suppose career started in about 1980, and I was lucky to work immediately with good bands because we had a lot of good friends in the area as well. So Matt Finish, The Angels, Hoodoo Gurus, Divinals, Oh my God. That was a great album. What a life.
Yeah.
Goodness. Cold Chisel. Then Barnsley.
Yep.
I did four albums for Jimmy. That was a long time. That's almost 10 years worth.
Yeah.
Who else? Machinations. Oh,
I love a bit of Machinations.
I need... Ice House.
Yep.
Who else was there? I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah,
I've got no memory.
you've given about a third of it, but that gives a good overall picture.
I was lucky. I think I did more content than anyone else has ever done in history because I was chief engineer in a very popular studio. So I came with the studio by default. If you didn't pay for me as an engineer, you got me as an assistant engineer.
Yeah. And for those of us, and there are a bunch of people hopefully listening to this that aren't musicians or worked in the recording industry, define what a chief engineer is in the context of a recording process.
In a studio like Rhino, which was cutting edge, chief engineer had to ensure customer service. So I had to make sure everything was top quality, all the gear was working properly, it was all aligned because it was all old analog gear. It's not like digital gear, just turn it on.
Mm.
It had to be aligned, it had to be test tones, and that took a long time. Had to make sure it was all happening, make sure the techs were on board, make sure the assistant engineers were doing their job and keeping out of the artist's face. So they had to be in the background, just getting coffee and tea and making sure the headphones hadn't blown up. So that was the job. So customer service and the way that you talk to artists to vibe them up, to love their environment, to love their work and to love the studio.
And again, for those that haven't worked in the industry, when you say customer service, you are with the producer, who's obviously the creative direction there with the band.
Well, you're the conduit between the producer, the gear and the band.
And you're usually, well, it depends, obviously producer, depending on how hands-on they are, you're sitting behind the console when the recording's happening.
Definitely.
Yeah.
We're right next to each other.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Listen Like Thieves a little bit then. I think everyone's aware of In Excess. Listen Like Thieves came on top of The Swing. The Swing had been a huge album in Australia for In Excess. They weren't that well known internationally at that stage.
No.
Listen Like Thieves came about, and it's not an understatement to say that was their first big international album. A lot of people get obsessed about Kick, and it's probably just the age I am, but I've never seen the appeal of Kick compared to Listen Like Thieves. That was the big one for me from a selfish viewpoint.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, that's right. So do you want to start off with some initial context of how – we've already talked about how they approach Rhinoceros as far as you've got the cutting-edge gear, great rooms, whatever. What was the impetus to kick it off? They were due to record another album. They approached you, and what happened from then?
Yeah, so well, their management was Chris Murphy management. Chris Murphy, brilliant man.
Mm.
You know, he had a vision. His mission was – world domination,
and
he wasn't going to let anything stand in his way. So it was a progression. So Shabu Shabar was the first album they did at Rhino.
Yep.
And that was with Mark Opitz at the helm. He did a wonderful job. That's Don't Change.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
What a great song.
Still play
so
today.
He pulled the best out of them. But it had a distinct Mark Opitz and Aussie Rock Angels pub sound, which was great, suited them. And then the next album, they used Nick Launay. So they were trying international producers now. Nick Launay was from England, from Townhouse, and I can't remember what his resume was.
Yeah,
I
he's done know. Some stuff. Oh, yeah, I didn't look
I should
up. Yeah,
I should have looked that up myself.
But definitely know the name.
He ended up doing all the Silverchair stuff.
That's right.
And Midnight Oil.
Yeah.
So he's done lots of great stuff. Yeah. But before that, I can't remember. He was only a young guy, but he was a tech head.
Yeah.
He knew his gear. So they were In Excess of tech heads as well.
Mm.
They always had cutting edge technology. You like this one, Andrew Farris.
Mm.
Great keyboard player.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a very frustrated guitarist.
he did play a little bit too at different times, didn't he?
Oh, he always played guitar.
Yeah,
he insisted.
Yeah.
Well, he did all the riffs.
Yeah, that's right.
And gave them to him. Yeah, this is what you're going to play. Go for it. He was brilliant. But he loved all his synths.
Yeah.
He had a million of them,
and
he knew how to use them. Yeah. And they're always brand new. You go, what's his Wave PPG thing? what's a CMI? you just bring them in, bang.
And
bang,
again,
bang.
For those not, I mean, he was at the stage, you know, a CMI was at that stage 40 grand.
Yeah.
It's just insane amounts of money, but yep, obviously paid off.
Oh, definitely, definitely. So we had a rock and roll Aussie album. Then we had the Nick Launay tech funky,
that was the swing,
poppy, the swing,
yep,
album, which was had like must have been six singles on that thing.
Oh, it's huge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It just burned for you. Yeah, they just kept going. Yeah. But it was a different direction for them. And they weren't big sounds. They were open sounds.
Yes.
So, and I think they must have talked about it and go, well, let's go in another direction. Let's kick it up again. So they looked for another producer and they picked Chris Thomas, the Beatles, Procol Harum.
So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about Chris Thomas. So, yeah, it's hard to overstate his role as a producer. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, starting with the Beatles, and he actually played... correct me if I'm wrong, basically he wrote to George Martin, said, I'm interested in getting into a career in this area, and he got a job as an assistant in the studio.
Yes.
George, the Beatles were recording, and I apologise, it was the White Album?
Yep.
The Beatles were recording the White Album.
One of their lesser-known ones, yes.
And my colleague Matthew, who usually joins me as co-host, is at Beatles Tragic Selby, shedding a tear that he's missing this. They're recording the White Album, and George Martin had some leave booked.
Yes.
And my understanding is he left a note for Chris Thomas, who came in to work after his leave. He'd just gotten back from holidays, and George Martin said something along the lines of, I'm off on leave, make yourself available for the boys in the Beatles, and you know, make sure you keep an eye on things are going. And he ended up playing a role with the recording of the White Album, including playing, I think it was five tracks, playing keyboard on five tracks of it.
Yeah, that's good research.
So that's just before he even started as a true producer. And as you mentioned, Procol Harum, he was doing their album during the day and running to do Dark Side of the Moon.
At
or was
night.
The other way around, it might have been Dark Side of the Moon during
the
up until midnight, and then going in at midnight to do Procol Harum. Anyway, whichever one it was.
Horrible life.
Massive pedigree and had, yeah, so he's been brought on board. What was your first contact with him?
When he first arrived in Australia.
I
just have to add something to your story that Chris Thomas, when he helped the Beatles as an engineer and a producer that first time, he went straight to two-track.
Okay.
Yeah, which is what he knew to do. Where George, I think, George Martin was at that stage using either four-track or eight-track. So when the band came in, they asked for more guitar and he couldn't do it. So that's one of his great stories of working with great people. George Harrison wanted more guitar. And I couldn't do it. I said, no, it's two track. And they went, two track?
Yeah, they wouldn't be used to that by White Album.
So they had to go back out and redo it to multi-track.
Yeah, that's interesting. So he turns up, he flies
He turns
over
up.
The
so Chris Murphy Management books the time in 1985. I can't remember what month it was. I've got no
it was
idea.
Around October, I think, something like that. Yeah.
And they would have booked 3 or 4 months before the recession.
Yeah, that's right.
When people could afford that. So, and he brought an engineer with him because he's coming to a strange country. Mm. He's got strange studio, strange environment, doesn't know the band that well. I'm not sure who he's met at this stage, who flew over to talk to him. And so he is gone. Shit, I better bring an engineer. He brings a guy called Steve Churchyard.
Okay.
Who has had an incredible career.
Since,
My knowledge of him was from the Cult.
Okay.
And from the Stranglers. Oh. So he had a good pedigree there. And he went on to be nominated for 8 Grammy Awards later on in his career.
Yeah.
I think he won 2 of them.
Stranglers alone would be enough of a CV.
Exactly. Yeah. So they arrived and lo and behold, I got the job as the assistant. And the way they worked just suited the way I worked so well.
Mm.
I was so into it. And the thing that was a saving grace for me was that Steve Churchyard couldn't work the desk.
Yeah.
He'd never used an SSL before. He was used to the old EMI Neves and the Tridents and the MCIs and stuff and whatever. So I had just this shoo-in straight away to do stuff, and it was just fantastic. And the band knew me. I'd already worked on
previous
two albums for them and worked separately with everyone because everyone in the In Excess got a chance to do B-sides.
Yep.
So once their albums were done or on the weekends on a Sunday, I'd stay back and I would do the B-sides with one of the kids. So they were kids then.
Yeah, they were.
Oh, my God.
So they would each write their own stuff. Yeah. And then, yeah.
Johnny Farris and I, we had a minor dance hit in New York.
Okay.
With one of his B-sides, yeah.
What was that called?
I think it was called I'm Over You. I just remembered that.
That's cool.
So they arrived and Churchyard couldn't use the desk, so I was setting up the desk. You could certainly use EQ and stuff.
Yeah.
He knew how to do all that stuff, and I knew how to do all the patching, so I'd be doing that. After a while, they trusted me to do the miking because they knew I knew the rooms,
yep.
So knew where to put the mics, and they were really happy with all the mic placement, which is, you know, you've got someone, the producer that works with the Pretenders.
Yes.
The Sex Pistols.
Yes.
Elton John, Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, I like how you did that miking.
Oh, look.
And you just go, uh-huh.
Yeah, it doesn't get much better than that.
Like, I've got chills.
Yeah, you should.
But it is cold in here, isn't it?
Yeah. That's good. It's an old man, I like it.
Yeah.
And so the relationship was pretty good then by the sound of it, got on well.
Oh, we had a great time.
Yeah.
And Chris Thomas at that stage, I don't know how old he was. He was older than me. I would have been about 30, I suppose, because I started my career a bit late.
Mm.
So 30-year-old assistant, but it worked great for Rhino.
Yeah.
Because I knew what to do.
Yeah.
I wasn't a coffee maker.
Yeah.
And so he might have been 40, and God, he knew his stuff.
Yeah.
And he had a way with people that you just trusted him. And he was also quite tough.
Okay.
You know, he wanted a sound, you had to get that sound.
Yes.
And he'd just wait for you. Come on.
Yeah.
Kick drum, rounder, fatter, bigger, boomier, toppier. Oh, God.
that's a challenge.
And he'd work. And he'd always make sure the headphone mixers were spot on. He wanted the most.
Yeah.
He'd always check them. It was really cool.
And from what I gather, they had, if not complete songs for the album, a hell of an idea of what they wanted to record. We'll talk about the missing single later. But
yeah, that was at the end of...
Well,
that's the great story.
That is a great story, yeah. So the process went relatively smooth. It was about 3 months worth, wasn't it?
About three months.
That's
a normal sort of recording session for that time.
Yeah.
Johnny Farris was very, very into his technology. He had an Akai sampler. I can't remember what...
Early days, yeah.
What model they were, the big silver box thing.
Yeah.
And he loved it. And what he would sit it next to him in the drum room, and he had a microphone, and he would use his voice and make a click sound, and then he would loop it in and get his tempo, and then he would play to that, and that's how he kept in time. He didn't really need it, but then he'd get a shaker and a tambourine or something,
yeah.
And we had a stereo line out of that to the board, so we would always record his click tracks, and I think... They're almost in every song
still
on that album.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm pretty sure they're either in the background or in the foreground. And live, he does the same thing live. He always mucks with his click tracks. And they become the percussion track. And it's just a brilliant thing to do. I've encouraged young drummers ever since then to do that. And none of them have ever really taken it up.
Yeah.
And I think they're missing out.
In Excess weren't groundbreakers with drummers, you know, triggering stuff like that, but they were certainly one of the bands that made it more mainstream.
More mainstream, and that gave them that funky edge as well, and allowed Gary Beers, the bass player, to put a bit more funk into his rock playing.
Yeah, that's
playing.
Right. No,
so absolutely. It was wonderful.
And so, I mean, the album itself, for those, I can't imagine the many out there listening that aren't aware of what's on that album, but even as far as well-known hits, they had, I think it was 5 or 6 singles again off the album.
Yep.
The ones that people most know are obviously
it was the big
What
three.
You Need,
yep.
Listen Like Thieves, Kiss the Dirt, and then
Shine Like It Does.
Yeah, Shine Like It Does, and This Time I'd Also Like is a massive song. and that's, you know, less than half the album. And I hadn't listened to it for a while, so I loved, played it to death as a teenager, listened to it three or four times in the last couple of weeks, and even the songs that you don't necessarily know that well now, it all holds up extremely well. I mean, hell, there's an instrumental in there. Which
isn't it weird? It's a very weird instrumental.
They were getting big, but they weren't, you could argue they weren't big enough to be thrown in an instrumental that, you know, was a little bit of a risk.
They wouldn't have put that into X or Kick or something.
They were still taking risks, and it all paid off.
They obviously must have come up with that in a rehearsal somewhere, and they've liked it.
Yeah, a great song. Three Sisters, isn't it? Yeah, Three Sisters. And so we'll get the mystery single out of the way and then talk about some other tracks. So, I mean, you get to the end of the session, the 3 months, or towards the end, and popular myth has it that Chris Thomas has said to the boys, there's not a single on here.
Oh, it's all true.
Yeah, yeah.
So there wasn't.
Tell us about that. Yeah.
So 3 months, we've done all the drums, all the basses, all the guitars, all the vocals. And I like to talk about the vocals a bit more later.
Please do.
And solos are done. Edits are done. Everything's in. We've got all these great rock tracks with funky bass lines and driving rhythms and great hooks and stuff. But there's no Burn For You or there's no Don't Change. They're glaringly missing. Huh? Great album tracks. And Chris Thomas is actually really concerned. And he started trying to change some of the songs around. But then he started putting it on Andrew. Andrew. Produce something, bring you something out. Yeah. So Andrew's gone through his, what are they called? Porter Studios.
Yeah.
His four-track Porter Studios, And he's playing different stuff to Chris and then different stuff to Michael. And they came out, I checked this up on Wikipedia, and it says it came out with a song called Funk
Song number 13. Yeah, yeah.
But I'm positive it was Funk number 9.
There you go.
Yeah. I think that was a 13, but the one that was what you need in the end was Funk number 9. And it was just that, how's it going again? God. So, and that was that start of using the Nile Rodgers type sound.
Yeah, it's got that.
Which has worked for him ever since.
Yes.
And it's just because they work with him in New York.
Okay.
Suicide Blonde? Is that when they did that?
Yeah.
And that was, it was just a stroke of genius because that type of guitar playing, that high-pitched upper register funk guitar that just cuts through, just drives, like in Daft Punk.
Yes.
So they reinvented it again.
Yeah, yeah.
So it just works so well.
Because Nile Rodgers worked with Daft Punk on their last album.
He played
it. Yeah, that's it. And some of those songs on there are incredible.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Is that a wig? that he wears?
I always wondered that. Yeah, it's a total aside. That Giorgio Moroder song on the last Daft Punk album where essentially Niall and the band jam with Daft Punk. It's just yeah, incredible. Some of the best musicians.
Da, 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 da. Yeah, is that the one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Got it.
Yep.
Took a while.
No, no, that's...
oh, is that a different one?
No, that's a different one. That's Good Kick.
Oh, it is too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the other thing I was going to say, and I know we're going to talk about vocals, with What You Need and a bunch of other songs, 85, saxophone was sort of starting to turn as an instrument. I mean, big yes. 70s instrument. I'd argue that that's one of the last albums where they made, for a while anyway, where they made the sax sound really cool,
yep.
really integral and not mm-hmm. dated.
Yeah.
In yes. What You Need and a couple of the other songs.
It's now called a sax offence.
Yeah. Yeah. So that said, I mean, you can argue with things like Never Tear Us Apart, and they went on to still use the sax integrally yep. in other albums. So you can argue that they kept it cool for a long time.
Hard to do.
It started to come back.
Yeah. But it's a great sound. It's like, as long as it's not too cheesy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But they used it well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... there's the single, so they and did Chris know from the time when they started laying that down that yeah, this is actually the single that was missing?
I think once the vocals, the guy vocal got put down, yeah, he knew it then. And then we spent, that was probably the least amount of time on any track, okay. that one, because there's only like 2 days left
yeah, yeah.
before they were flying back
okay,
to take all the tapes and go mixing.
So they nailed it.
Yeah.
So you mentioned vocals there. Let's talk about vocals. So what was the process with vocals throughout that album and what really stood out for you?
The vocal, I think the process is the important part. As we know, Michael Hutchence was a great lyricist, great singer, great front man, great personality. So, you know, it's hard to fault anything that he did.
Nah.
He would park himself in – we had four studios, and the fourth one was around the corner. You couldn't really see it. It was called Studio C, and it was just this beautiful... Remember, I did the boats,
yep.
and I was like, I used to do all the soft furnishings.
Yeah,
the whole thing was just a dead room. Okay. This beautiful... It was called Torp. It was like this purpley colour material, cotton material, and it was just lovely to be in. It had a really nice, lovely couch, and he would be in there with his... thesaurus, his dictionary, his record player, his four track, and just his pad and pen and his thoughts. And we would just keep feeding him where we were up to with the songs, constantly giving him another cassette, bang, bang, bang. And he would just start doing his wordsmithing. And he would just be drawing on, because it's always about him.
Yeah, yeah.
If you look at all the songs, Shine Like It Does. Like it's about him and One by One, Good Times, Bad Times. So there's already that feeling of success and the power it has and what it does to you and loneliness. You can feel all that in the songs.
And for those that, again, haven't been involved in recording issue that may be a bit surprised, that essentially the instrumentation was being put down before the vocals.
So definitely.
Yeah.
A lot of times we hadn't even heard it.
Yeah, that's
right. Hadn't heard it. So Andrew Farris... was the great riff master.
Yeah.
He would do the hooks. He would all those keyboard lines. There's I don't know how he does it live. There's 1,000 changes that he must do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you'd have to have, you know, song 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, here we go. Yeah.
And so, all right, so Michael would work on that, come in, record the vocal.
Yeah, he'd come in and throw down some ideas. And then ask, you know, for guidance or how's this, how's that, and they get feedback from the producer and from Andrew, and then he'd go back into his room, and then he'd go missing for 3 days, and he'd come back, and then he'd have a little party,
yeah,
and then he might wait until everyone went home, and he'd work with me if I was there, and just put down some ideas so he didn't have any pressure, and that was always a good time. That was great fun.
And how many, so across, I mean, you've got 11 final tracks and, and you have some artists that will go in, record 11 and use 11. You've got others, like I know, for example, Springsteen for Darkness on the Edge of Town had something like 70 songs or 90 songs that, from which he took the album. So where were these guys falling? You know, you ended up recording over 3 months, 20 songs, and ended up with 11 or?
11.
11, 11, yeah. So that's, which is not unusual, yeah. And that usually to me shows the focus of someone that is, they got a shitload of good stuff.
Yeah. Well, they did. They were very confident with what they had. And they played it superbly. And they really, because of Chris's attitude towards sound and performance, he really pushed him into that international rock.
Yeah.
So like that Pretenders.
Yes.
Now remember Honeyman Scott's guitar sound. So it's all over there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it's beautiful. And I think that's the precursor to that down, 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 down type sound.
Yeah.
Definitely, that's where that came from.
And so, I mean, it's been a long time since. And I said before that recording was in October. I think the album was released in October, and from memory, it started in August. So it was a fairly close from when you finished production and then mixing, mastering, or whatever. It came out not long after.
Yeah, they wouldn't want to muck around.
No.
Because they'd have to go tour it.
Yeah, that's right.
And that stage, they were very popular around the world. Like, they weren't that known, but they were like Japan.
Yeah.
They were like number one band in Japan.
Yes.
And that did great for their accounts.
Yeah.
It gave them the freedom to get the big producers in and get they had Pearl sponsorships and Selwyn and Tokai and Fender, and so they were doing good.
Yeah. Favorite babies? When you look back, either at the time, the favourite ones that you enjoyed the most recording, but in retrospect, looking back, the ones that really stand out for you as the best songs for you?
Well, I'd have to go back to The Swing. So I'm just going to do that.
Yeah, you do that. And then I want your favourite bands from Listen Like Thieves as well.
So working on The Swing was really different because Lorne's approach to things. And he had a favourite microphone, which was a Beyer M88, which is predominantly supposed to be for bass, but it's a tight bass mic. Mm. And he used it on everything.
Okay.
He did vocals, kick drums, snare drums. It was just everywhere. We had to get a few of them in to do that. So we just had this album that was so tight. And doing Burn For You, and when we heard the backing vocals, which was Jenny Morris and... what's the girl's name from the Models? Oh, God. Had her own solo career. The Canadian girl. We know the one.
I keep wanting to say, and I know it's not Kate Sobrano.
She came in too.
Yeah, she did. Okay. Yeah.
Kate Sobrano. That was a magical song to work on. Yeah. And standing on the jetty. My God. No. So, Listen Like Thieves, going back to that, I think... I was a big fan of Kiss the Dirt. Playing in the dust, we find the seeds of doubt. Don't water them with your tears. Don't think about all the years. You'd rather be without. Just the way that the lyric reminded you of falling down the mountain. Like there was this rolling lyric that went over the top of those driving guitars. And that's Andrew. And so there's three guitars on that. There's Andrew, Tim and Kirk.
Okay.
All playing. I think they all played Strats probably.
Yeah.
And they just kicked it.
So that's the fave. And any ones that, do you recall at the time, had you pulling your hair out?
I think This Time.
Okay.
Doing the vocals on that was very, very tricky.
Yeah.
Because they're very high it's not the best lyric at all.
Yeah.
It's quite grating.
Yes.
So to make that sound appealing was difficult.
Well, you achieved it because, that's definitely one of my...
So, but it was a difficult one to do. I've seen you before. Turn and walk away. You say you won't come back.
We are hoping, yes, and we're praying. This time
because it's so high. This time.
Yeah.
So everyone's got to sing it perfectly. And they're rock guys. So it's hard, you know, not Pavarotti's, but they pulled it off.
Yeah, most cover bands don't tend to cover that one.
No. You wouldn't want to be doing that one. But Shine Like It Does.
Yeah.
That's a great track.
Yeah.
And so I was lucky in the sense that when there's no room at the board for three people.
No.
So Churchyard had the board. Chris had the production and he was in charge of the speakers and the sound and the band. And that left me in charge of all the outboard gear, all the mics. And in those days, it was 2-inch tape machines.
Yeah.
And we had big Studer and an older type Studer, 224 tracks slaved together all the time. And Chris was a bit of a purist. So you had to do everything like first generation.
Okay.
So we were always running two machines all the time and not doing much transferring.
No.
And that was pretty tricky. And that ended up we had like almost 100 reels of tape.
Yeah.
There was a lot of tape. And you had to – so your file management was incredible.
No spreadsheets.
So, no, and I was always writing notes and there was stuff everywhere. But it was my job to do all the recording, all the dropping in, all the erasing, and it's a tricky position
any
to be in.
Any close calls there?
Not with that album, no.
No, cool.
Other albums, yes.
Yes. Well, that happens to all.
Freight Train Heart, Jimmy Barnes. We got a bit out of it one night.
Yeah.
And we just finalised backing vocals with Vanetta Fields and Renee Geyer.
Yeah.
And Shauna Jensen. And I was cleaning up all their talking because I had a few drinks and stuff. So, hey, Jimmy, you can hear it all the way through the track. So my job is to clean it up. And so put all tracks in record, all channels are muted. So it's nice and clean because you don't want to hiss or anything. And then I got to drop out before the chorus comes in or wherever they're singing. And I think it was Renee distracted me. She asked me something and I turned around. And just as I turned around, I realised, no! And I clipped. That was one of the only times I ever did anything really bad. And I couldn't – there was a unique part in the song. There was only one of them. So I had to get them to go out and do it again, but they're okay.
Yeah.
But I've never forgotten it.
And Freight Train Heart, just as an aside, as a rabid Springsteen fan and listeners, I'll try not to bring Springsteen too much into these episodes, but I assume Van Zandt didn't turn up to see his song being recorded?
Because he
didn't. Ride the Night Away,
I think it was. Gonna ride the night away. No.
No.
No, wish but there was there's a lot of a lot of good stories in that album.
Yeah. I can imagine. That's another whole episode.
Oh yeah, I've got a really embarrassing one.
But don't tell me on In Excess side of things. So Good Times when they did the Barnsley Hutchins one. That was after Listen Like Thieves. I think it was after.
Yeah, it was 86.
Yeah.
So it was after.
So it wasn't part of those. It wasn't obviously part of those sessions. That was after.
Because all those guys were very intertwined, especially Australian Made was coming up.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was all the major acts doing that. I think Mushroom organised that.
Yeah.
So there was the NXS band and the Jimmy Barnes band, and I think the Angels.
Okay.
Played a part in that as well. Like Rick Brewster was in there, and because Ganga Jang were friends with everyone, and
yeah,
and the Ganga Jang, Give Me Some Lovin',
yeah.
That was done because Buzz was playing drums on some of the Barnsley stuff, and he asked if he could use some of Barnsley's outtake tapes that Barnsley wouldn't use because they had edits in them
because
they had no money.
No.
So he said, and we gave him some tape, and I was engineering after the Barnsley session, and the tape we used for Give Me Some Lovin' was so bad. I had to put little bits of tape into the gaps and stuff that were missing, and you can hear the edits go through all the time. So we had to put percussion in certain places to cover up all the edits.
Yeah.
So that's how great bands and great songs start.
And there's another whole episode, Ganga Jang.
Oh, yeah. It's all intertwined. Johnny Diesel's in there too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's close. Yeah.
And Bon Jovi. plays a part.
Oh, really?
Tico Torrens came in and played some drums on 7 Days, Bob Dylan cover.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah, that's a big album. So, I mean, what are we looking? 80, it's 30 years. 30.
You've got me started now.
2 years since Listen Like Thieves wrapped. So,
really?
Yeah, I'm just, if I'm doing my maths right, 85.
Oh, shit.
2017, yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm an old man.
It definitely is an album that sits well in rock history. What does it mean to you now?
Oh, I still listen to it because I do a lot of live work now.
Yeah, yeah.
And as a live sound guy in pubs and stuff, because I just love doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Also the DJ. Yeah. So it's my phone is just full of, well, it's, I take pride in a lot of the work I've worked on. So my whole phone is just Aussie rock.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good stuff.
So, you know, Kiss the Dirt and Shine Like It Does and Listen Like Thieves and What You Need. And they're always high on my playlist and people love them.
Oh, yeah. You always just, get people.
It doesn't matter what age.
No.
They just go off. They just start dancing straight away.
Yeah. Well,
and to me, I don't think they're dance songs.
No. They don't stand out as ones. No.
No, but they are.
Yeah.
People just love it. And they know the words. They'll just sing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fair to say albums like this are a huge group effort. I mean, obviously the band are pivotal, the producer, but I think it's fair to say you definitely had an influence on that album. And
I like to think so because I like to think that my sound was rock.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And for rock, we thank you. That sounds like something Jack Black would say.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Yeah. He probably has said it. I probably just ripped it off from some movie. But no, thanks, Al. Can't thank you. I mean, I think we could honestly have the Al Wright podcast. I reckon we could easily get 50 episodes out of
I reckon you could too.
Which you've done.
Yeah.
But for this.
Are we near done, are we?
We are. Or throw in 3 more anecdotes from Listen Like Thieves. I can guarantee you the listeners won't want it to finish.
Okay. Well, I think let's go back to Michael because he's such an icon. His lyrics to me were always about change.
Mm-hmm.
He was always singing about, like, I'm not sure if he wanted to change or if he wanted his situation to change or if he was happy with it and sad with it. And it's such a minefield of, like, psychology. And it's just wonderful to listen to it and to get the feeling of someone that's so in the limelight, but you also feel like they don't want to be there.
Yes.
It was. It's quite intriguing.
So it felt like he was a bit conflicted, which I know a lot of
I think so, like that, yeah.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to spend some time with him in, you know, those notorious bars like Benny's and stuff like that. And I had a unit just down the road from Benny's. It was only like I lived there purposely because of that. So I could just zip home and get changed and go back. And
that's right.
Because he didn't have much time. And so if we needed something, and a lot of artists would come back to my place to freshen up or whatever, or just chill out. You could sleep there if you want or change clothes. And I remember him, he came there one night. And the first night he came there, you got to remember that even though they hadn't had major American success, they were actually quite rich already.
Oh, it would be, yeah.
They were all driving Porsches and they had
in the good old days where you could make money out of someone else.
And they had terrace houses in Potts Point and they were living in Japan. They had another house in Japan. Mm. And so he came to my place and I'll never forget his words. He goes, "You live here?" And then I think from then on, he realised what the life of a sound engineer was like.
Yes.
My place, I lived in the lounge room.
Yeah.
I didn't even bother sleeping in the bedroom. I just slept on the couch every night with the TV on and, you know, a bottle of beer next to me. And he actually started to like it. He came a few more times and chilled out there. It was a great time for me.
Absolutely.
I was really proud of all that.
That's one hell of an anecdote. And overall, the process, I mean, it's easy to get into the whole band dynamic thing and there's not a band in existence that doesn't have conflicts or, like, anyone that does, they'd be psychotic.
Listen Like Thieves, actually, I don't think I witnessed any conflict in three albums. I don't think – the only conflict they ever had was with me.
And sorry, I should
– Johnny Farris yelled at me once.
There you go. Oh, I should qualify that. It's either tends to be conflict or distance. And so by this stage of success, I mean, quite rightly, Michael's off writing lyrics. He needs the privacy.
Yep.
But, I mean, you that many years in, you're not best mates anymore necessarily. Or you are your blood brothers, maybe.
Yep. You're there for a purpose.
You're there for a purpose and you do want some distance.
Yeah, you got to, well, definitely. Yeah. So you can treat people like friends, but when you go back in the studio.
Yeah, it's business. Yeah.
Full on business. Yeah, it's very serious.
And you've already mentioned Chris got on well with the band. They're obviously happy with him. Although they didn't end up recording anything else with Chris, did they?
Yeah, he did the next two albums.
That's right. He did the next two. That's right.
He took him to the top.
Poor research.
Oh, man, his sounds. He killed it. Yeah. He kept those big open sounds. Space. Yeah. He created space for the band.
Yeah.
You hear it on Thieves all over the place. There's space.
Oh, yeah.
Space for the riffs.
And it's one of the, it's an international album, but it's also, I'd argue, one of their most Australian ones.
I would say so too.
It just feels so Australian.
Yeah. And Chris Thomas, well, by that stage, was in his 40s. He had a new girlfriend. I think they were about to get married. And so he was like going through this big change in himself and he was trying to get a bit healthier. Mm. So he was starting to get really focused and he would always stop for dinner and most of us would always go with him to dinner. So that was the camaraderie.
Yeah, so good teamwork there.
Yep, yeah, great teamwork. And he introduced me to red wine. So thank you, Chris.
I find that hard to believe.
No, I'd never drunk it before.
Really?
Yeah, I was like a beer and a bourbon and Coke sort of man. So, and Stolly, of course.
Yeah.
And he would always have red wine and have a glass of this. And, man, that stuff is rocket fuel.
Yeah, yeah.
You drink half a bottle of that really quick and boom, you're gone.
And, I mean, one last question probably about Michael, and it's always that hypothetical and it's same whether it goes for Lennon and others that passed away early. It's always interesting to think about whether he would have gone on to produce more great work or whether he'd really hit, and no one knows, whether he'd hit with the swing,
it's hard
kick,
to say,
Listen Like Thieves, those big three in particular, that's like, how can you top that really?
I don't know. All I can think of, the thing that comes to my mind is that he might have become a hermit. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true, to get away from it, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's on the Luke side. Obviously, Andrew Farris has still been creating music ever
since. Well, I was lucky enough to work with Andrew on Jenny Morris's Shiver album,
which was a sublime album.
And what we did, so it was just Andrew and myself and an assistant engineer. And by that stage, I was very confident. I had all my sounds down. We had Ricky Fattah on drums.
Okay.
From the Ruttles and the Beach Boys, and it was because he moved to Australia.
Yeah.
And that album, we based that on the White Album.
Okay.
We listened to the White Album over and over again, not so much for recording, but when we went to mix it and we experimented. So if you listen to that album now, all the stereo is different to what the normal, say, Motley Crue stereo or.
Yeah, yeah.
And we also listened to Michael Jackson.
Yeah, well,
to get the width and depth that Quincy Jones got out of that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And the Jenny Morris album's another one that there was, what, 3, 4, 5 big hits.
Big hits.
Amazing, amazing album. I might let you off the hook. I feel like I should be letting you get back to recording the next White Album.
I'd love to do that.
I'm sure I've forgotten stuff to ask, but I think that gives a brilliant overview of what is truly a great album and its impact that it's had on you. And I know it's had a hell of an impact on me. So
yeah, me too. Let's do another one. Let's pick another album.
Oh, mate, I'd have you on for 50 episodes. Okay. We'll talk, because I tell you now. If you'd like to give us feedback, listeners, on albums that Al's mentioned, or if you look up Al's biography, which I'll link to in the show notes, we can definitely, if he's up for it, bring him back.
Okay.
Thanks,
Please
Al.
Do. Thank you, David.
So there we have it. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I obviously did. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Al's a great guy, and what comes through in that interview is just how much knowledge he has of the Australian music industry, particularly from that period in the 80s and 90s, but still going today. And as we also mentioned at the end of the interview, if you do have an album that Al's mentioned outside of Listen Like Thieves, or another album in his discography, and it is a very long discography. The link again will be in the show notes. Do drop us a line, because we're more than happy to revisit some other albums. I think Al's got plenty of entertaining anecdotes still to come. So I think otherwise we'll wrap it up there. As always, if you'd like to offer an opinion, suggestion, or even offer yourself up as a guest to review an album you love, feel free to email us at contact@themusicweek.net or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/musicdissectors. All the previous episodes, all two of them, of the show are on iTunes, and we're also on Stitcher and TuneIn, and all episodes are also on our website at www.themusicweek.net. So we'll be back in a few weeks with Matthew refreshed from his holiday. In the meantime, find a new album to love. Goodbye.